be. Silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, before we begin, I'd like to have my new best friends, who I met over lunch, the students and their advisors from La Follette High School, please stand. Please? I know you're here.
It was a trick question.
Thank you. I just wanted my colleagues on the court to see you all. We are very pleased to have you in court with us, so please be seated. Now, the students are here on a project called Court with Class, so they've had an opportunity to look at the briefs, and they're going to know a little bit about what you're going to argue to us today. Are you ready to proceed? Okay, then I'll call our last case for the day, Stuart White versus the City of Watertown. Please begin.
May it please the court. I was encouraged to use my outdoor voice, so I'll try to do that. If I step away from the microphone, I appreciate your reminding me of that. Good afternoon. My name is Attorney Joe Wirth. I have the opportunity to represent the City of Watertown in this matter, the petitioner in this case, and we are here today respectfully requesting that this court overturn the published decision of the Court of Appeals, which held that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals found the Chapter 90 of our Wisconsin statutes to be ambiguous, and that because of those ambiguities, interpreted that chapter as requiring that cities and villages assume regulatory duties in fence disputes between property owners. It is our position that Chapter 90 in its entirety is applicable only to towns, and that the several potentially conflicting or confusing references within that chapter should be resolved by a plain reading of the statute and of the questioned sentences, rather than, as has both the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, adding language to the statute that was not placed there by the legislature.
Counsel, Chapter 990 might inform our analysis here. And specifically, there's a definition for town given. Town may be construed to include cities, villages, wards, or districts. How would you have us apply that language?
Let's take a little break. You can take him off the clock for a minute. The court has created an emergency.
So we need some tissue.
That's right. Yeah, we will let you begin again. Sorry. That's why we don't bring drinks out on the counter.
Apparently, Justice Dallet wanted to make a splash.
She did.
Showing the students that justices are people, too.
Oh, is that it? Okay. Well played. Deputy Pond is there.
And occasionally I bring.
All right,
see? Okay.
Counsel, do you need my question again?
I don't. I don't.
Okay. You got a good long time to think about it.
Justice Bradley, wait till he gets back on the
time. Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay. We're back on the clock? Excellent.
Okay.
My response to that observation is that within that chapter, I recognize that discussion is held. Within the management opportunities that are afforded cities, villages, and towns, there are differing levels of responsibility, differing levels of independence, and differing levels of home rule, as the phrase goes. So my suggestion is that while the forms of government are sometimes used en masse, they are local entities that are distinct in their operative abilities and distinct in the powers that are devolved to them from the state of Wisconsin. The position being that the municipalities do not act except for the powers given them by the state of Wisconsin. And I think that's part of what we have in this case. The state of Wisconsin has ascribed to towns this responsibility and this enforcement ability, which it has not done to cities and villages. So although there are colloquialisms and statutes, as the court has pointed out, where towns can broadly be defined as cities, villages, and towns, when we get down to the municipal corporation or incorporation, these are distinct entities, and the powers that they are able to exercise are distinct by what the state has assigned to them.
Could you apply that analysis specifically to the statutory sections that we're looking at under Chapter 90?
Sure. I think that I'll start at the back end and then work forward. If there is no distinction between towns and cities and villages, what we end up with is what the Court of Appeals and what the Circuit Court has essentially assigned to cities and villages, and that is this capacity under Chapter 70 to put charges on property owners' tax bills. I don't want to go too far afield, but that chain of responsibility can lead to a foreclosure action on behalf of the county. If the charges are not paid by the property owner after being placed on their tax bill, then sections of Chapter 70, that becomes the dual responsibility of the municipality and of the county. And at some point, if it remains unpaid long enough, we can have a city property owner, facing a foreclosure action brought by either the county or the municipality, who is going to stand before this court and say, upon what power can you foreclose on my property?
So, counsel, applying the fence statute to the cities is not an unusual thing in the sense of never having been done before, correct?
Well, I think that when you say it's never been done before, I don't know which case specifically you're referring to.
I'm referring to the laws of 1875 that provides that the aldermen of the respective wards of said city and the trustees of any such village are hereby empowered, and it is hereby made their duty to discharge the duties imposed upon fence viewers of the several towns as provided by this chapter in their respective wards and villages.
That is correct. In 1875, the initial revenue statutes that had been developed, I think, around 1850, did make a change and did assign language that specifically brought both property owners under the auspices of the revenue statute, and assigned those duties, those enforcement responsibilities to cities and villages. Perhaps the crux of this dispute is that when those changes were formally codified in 1878, those two provisions, bringing landowners under the auspices of the chapter and assigning to cities and villages the enforcement and both responsibilities and the courses of action, were removed.
At the same time that they were removed, the very same act removing that provision also added Chapter 204, Section 4971, the predecessor to Chapter 990 that Justice Rebecca Bradley had cited. And that provision says the word town may be construed to include all cities, wards, or districts, unless such construction would be repugnant to the provisions of any act specially relating to the same. In 1878, would it have been repugnant for town to refer to a city?
I think that if the question is whether the analogy to the predecessor of Chapter 990 is repugnant, the answer is arguably not. However, at the time those two were created, the references to the powers to the city were removed from the city.
Yes, but at the same time, it expanded the definition of town to include city. Why should we not, in the very same act that made the change, why should we not give effect to what the legislature said about what town means?
the legislature, keeping in mind that what the legislature is doing is something specific and something general. And when the legislature specifically withdrew from that statute the powers to act, that should be the intent of what the legislation created.
Why should we construe it that way instead of saying, perhaps, that they simply wanted to use a change in the definition to make it as inclusive as it was before?
A change in the definition of towns?
Yes.
Okay.
To make it as inclusive as it had been in 1875. So in 1878, you had, there were wholesale changes, right? There was an act that repealed nearly everything in our statutes and recreated them. Yeah?
Right.
And one of the things they recreated is this provision, but they recreated it a little bit differently. And so when we look at the way that they recreated it, shouldn't we look at that as a whole, using the definitions that they provided to us? So we see that aldermen can qualify as fence viewers, and then there's the enforcement mechanism that applies to towns. What does towns mean? Well, we have a definition section provided by the very same legislature that made the statutory change. And says towns can be cities.
Although I understand that reading, the definition of towns to include or can include, et cetera, would remove any ambiguity. There would be no reason then to include these definitions of who can act as a fence viewer.
Well, sure. A village trustee is not the same thing as a city alderman. Right? So you have the definition section of who can be a fence viewer, and that says city aldermen can be fence viewers, and then everything else speaks in towns in terms of town because the legislature said town can include city.
I think that I would argue that's too broad an ascription or prescription for how cities are to know they have these powers to act, how cities are and villages are to know that they assume these responsibilities.
Well, they can look at the definition section, can't they?
Well, the answer is that when you're doing something, when you are extending to a municipal corporation a specific power to act, I don't think you can just, I mean, I don't think, for instance, that the legislature, when it creates a statute that gives to the city a power, it automatically means that power flows to towns and villages.
So perhaps we should look for textual cues to determine whether the legislature wrote an act that could be read in that way, right? So we look at the present version of the statute, which is virtually similar to what it was in 1878, and that nominates city aldermen as fence viewers, right? If we read towns to exclude cities, what is it that a city alderman acting as a fence viewer is actually going to do?
It's going to be, as we said in our brief, the pool of fence viewers who can come and do this for a town.
Yeah, and then after he does that, what happens?
Well, then the enforcement power becomes that of the town.
Well, towns don't have authority over cities.
I didn't hear you.
Towns don't have authority over cities, do they?
No. I would characterize it as borrowing. I can borrow a town alderman. I mean, there are, obviously, as the court is aware, we have counties that are hundreds of square miles wide, or hundreds of square miles in area. And the townships have a pool from which they can draw fence viewers.
I believe, counsel, that it refers that the statute nominating city aldermen as fence viewers refers to them being fence viewers in a specific area, don't they?
It says fence viewer. It says alder persons within their district.
Right. So you can't borrow.
So I can't what?
So you can't borrow.
What do you mean?
Well, if he's a fence viewer only within his aldermanic district, he can only view fences in a city. In particular, in that aldermanic district of that city.
Unless what that passage says is a alderman in his district. I mean, a man in his house, an alderman in his district.
Why would you need to say that, though? That's a little superfluous, right? If we were just saying fence viewers can be aldermen, trustees, et cetera, why would the legislature have needed to say the alderpersons or of cities in their respective aldermanic districts? Why? I mean, that language means nothing if it doesn't mean they're only able to be fence viewers in their respective districts, right?
I think that's one interpretation. I think the other interpretation is that's how they talked in 1878.
Okay, and so if it is one interpretation, you have to agree the statute's ambiguous. Because if more than two, ambiguity is two people reading it two different ways. You're reading it one way, they're reading it another, and if you look at the language, it's unclear, right?
I would say that the chapter itself is not ambiguous. The wording in that statute is.
And the wording is, and we know from what we've, if we call it ambiguous and we go to legislative intent, we know that the intent of the statute was to be able to have an enforcement provision, because why else would you have someone in a city have to comply with these provisions that tell them how they are supposed to build their fences if they can never enforce it if their neighbor won't pay?
I don't know. That's the one of the points. I don't think that the terms of Chapter 90... The Court of Appeals said it is implicit in the city's argument that it agrees the terms of Chapter 90 apply to landowners. The city does not agree with that. The city does not agree that the Chapter 90 in its entirety applies to cities and villages. So the Court of Appeals' argument in that respect was 90.03 doesn't say it doesn't apply to cities. But that's a slippery slope argument. If we're gonna talk about what statutes don't say, and therefore they mean everything else, then we're in trouble.
Well, I agree with that, because I do like to look at the language, but when you look at partition fences when required, it doesn't tell you that you're only required in a certain place, like a town. It doesn't tell you anything about where it's required, so it seems to apply to all people everywhere.
Well, that's what the Court of Appeals interpreted. And our argument is it's placed in a town chapter. So it is directed to towns.
Why is it placed in a town chapter? The chapter is called fences.
Right, but of the, I think, 16 different substatutes, 14 of them apply only to towns by their language, by their plain language.
Or they say nothing either way. 14 of them don't say town. I don't know how many, but, right? Okay.
Or like 90.03, it doesn't say either way.
Council, I want to make sure I understand your position on this. I'm going to read to you section 90.01. The supervisors in their respective towns, the alderpersons of cities in their respective aldermanic districts, and the trustees of villages in their respective villages shall be fence viewers. Is it your position that what that actually means is supervisors, alderpersons, and trustees shall be fence viewers?
Yes.
Why all the extra language?
Again, the it's definitely confusing.
I don't think it's confusing. I think we know what respective means, right? We know what respective means.
Yes.
Yeah. It establishes a relationship between a predicate and a subsequent term. Right? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So the supervisors in their respective towns is drawing a relationship between the supervisors in the towns. And the relationship is in there. So supervisors are fence viewers in their towns. Alderpersons are fence viewers in their cities or their aldermanic districts, right? What principle would we use to excise all of that language?
I don't think it's necessary to excise the language. What the court is doing, what Your Honor is doing, is saying that the cadence of those four words suggests that the alderperson is a fence viewer, moving that word up into that phrase, in their districts.
Yes.
What it does, however, what the plain language actually establishes is that a fence viewer may be an alderman in his district. So
as opposed to an alderman outside of his district.
As opposed to just an alderman without the superfluous language afterwards.
Okay. But an alderman in his district is something different than just an alderman, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't think it is. I mean, I think an alderman in his district is a definition of an alderman. Someone who is a representative in their district is an alderman.
So the phrase in their respective is surplus.
I believe it is it is surplus in this instance because of the responsibility, because of the practice to consider the singular against the whole.
Is it necessary to read it that way? Is it necessary to read in their respective each time that is used? Is it necessary to read to understand that, excuse me, as being surplusage?
I don't think so, because if we assume that it's definitional as opposed to locational, I'll use those phrases. An alderman in his district is an alderman by definition. The court is suggesting, what if we read it to say an alderman in his district is locational? The alderman can only be a fence viewer while he's in his district.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question becomes, if there are two competing interpretations of that phrase, does it matter? Is that what you're asking? I mean, do we have to read it one way for the rest of the chapter to only be applicable to towns?
Right. So what I want to know is whether your reading of the statutory material requires that we read in their respective as having no independent meaning.
I don't think so. I don't think that for the city to prevail in its argument, the court has to ignore in their respective districts.
Okay. So we could give it some meaning.
Well, it depends on the meaning. Yes, exactly.
Well, if we give it some, is there a meaning that we could give it that would not be surplusage, that is different from what I've described already?
Well, I think the difference comes down to whether we view it as 1878 language of identification as opposed to 1878 language of operational fields.
Are you suggesting that this is poetry?
I'm not suggesting it's poetry. I am suggesting, as I think every court, probably including this one, who has gone through this legislative history, it's a difficult read. It was written in a time where its application to towns, to this day, towns are over 90% of the land area in the state of Wisconsin.
Right.
But
the legislature had no compunction about applying the fence statute to cities in 1875. Right.
It didn't, but then it changed it. It didn't, but then it took it out. It didn't survive. Let's
well, it
put
changed.
It that way.
Okay. So it didn't survive in that form.
In that form.
Right.
Right.
So what it could be is that there actually is meaning to the phrase in their respective, and what it means is it is locationally bounded, and that when the same legislature that made that change added a provision saying that towns could be construed to mean cities, that was the import of the full statute, is that we are simply describing this in a different way from we did before. But it does the same thing.
The court is pointing out what it perceives as an ambiguity, but the context of the statute within the chapter gives cities and villages no recourse. In other words, if that interpretation becomes the law of the chapter, so to speak, then that same interpretation, actually in addition to that interpretation, has to be added to all of the enforcement chapters.
Well, I don't know, because the section that, the provision that added this said that it can be read to include cities unless it would be repugnant to the statutory structure. Right?
And our argument is it becomes repugnant.
Okay. So that's what I want to know. So in 1875, the legislature says the fence statute applies to cities. 1878, why would it in 1878 become all of a sudden repugnant to the statutory scheme to have the fence statute apply to cities?
By the specific action of taking that language, taking that enforcement power, which mentioned, keeping in mind that in 1875, the change the court points out was equally applicable to their actions in putting in cities and villages specifically. Then they took it out.
Do you make anything of the note that went along with that, the revisor's note that specifically said the owner of an enclosed lot in a city ought as much to contribute to a partition fence between himself and neighbor as the owner of an enclosed lot in a town?
I think that comment was written as the justification. I mean, I think what happened in 1875, between 1875 and 1878, are two things were removed. First, what was removed is the application of the chapter to landowners. Second, what was removed is the enforcement responsibilities and powers of cities and villages. The comment that Your Honor is referring to was the explanation for why the removal of the landowners was taken out between 1875 and 1878. That comment essentially saying, we view that as potentially limiting who this might be applicable to.
Or maybe it's just how they talked in 1878. I mean, that's right. I mean, that argument could go for explaining a lot of this, right?
There is a certain assumption that must be undertaken when we're talking about language from 140 years ago. but as Justice Kelly pointed out, there's a thread that goes down one path, and there's what I would suggest is a plain language thread that goes down a different path. Now, the ambiguity that that may create forces the court to do one of two things. Either say the plain language of the definition is definitional as opposed to locational. And therefore, if the legislature wants this applicable to cities and villages, put it in. Or it goes down the other path where the definitional is locational, and because of that, arguably then, additional words have to be added to a dozen other sections in this chapter because of this concept that back in 1875 and in chapter 990, there is a reference that the word town can include cities.
What additional words would need to be added to this statute?
City clerk, city treasurer, register of deeds, village treasurer, village clerks, those kinds of the creation of the power to have cities and villages act would need to be placed into the statutes, into the enforcement elements of the statutes.
So do you have any sources that are roughly contemporaneous to 1878 that suggests that the way that legislators talked at that time would make the provision relating to who can serve as fence viewers definitional as opposed to locational?
The 1 Wis 122, the case that was put in there by the Court of Appeals, his name now escapes me, Brooks v. Allen, where they were discussing the predecessor of Chapter 90. If you read the language in that opinion, where the litigants are talked about, I won't use the language. I won't use flowery as a language, but it's definitely 1800s language. I mean, we're talking about an appellate opinion that's not too long after the Civil War.
Yeah, can you point me to the specific part of the opinion to which you're referring?
Well, it's 1 Wis 2nd 127, and where they're talking about ordinary fences of the country and not the fences of town, village, and city lots. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about at that time, that mindset, that Supreme Court that sits at the same time the legislature is doing these kinds of changes, envisions the application of this statute to fences of the country. And
yeah, but that was from 1853.
Okay, so it's right before the Civil War.
Yeah, and it's also before the statutory section that applied the fencing requirements to cities.
Specifically, yes.
Okay, so what am I supposed to learn from an 1853 case about how legislators talk and use phrases such as in their respective?
Well, I'm not going to be so bold as to suggest that the the language in that case is maybe ascribed to, you know, the legislators 25 years later. I can't do that. What I can suggest to you, though, is that the atmosphere at the time that case was decided and 10 years after the Civil War, 15 years after the Civil War, when essentially most of our statutes were rewritten in 1878, the purpose, the intent, the focus of that statute was fences in the country. That's what I would suggest.
Well, here we are today, gathered to decide this case. And it seems to me that your argument might lead to an absurd result. That is, what about these poor people in the city and the villages? What if they have a disagreement about a fence line? What are they to do? Are they second-class citizens and residents here?
The reality is that what we're talking about are what are called partition fences. The difficulty of that is that there is no definite. I mean, partition fences are that which divide the boundaries between properties for farming and grazing. And that's in the statute. So the, I don't know if mindset is an appropriate term, but the mindset of the statute is partition fences separating properties that act in farming and grazing. I can anticipate that a micro farmer in the city, or someone who apparently chickens are now a big deal in the cities.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So I can understand that a property owner of micro farming or chicken raising fancies themselves as a farmer and may go to their neighbor and say, you have to fix half my fence so my chickens don't end up in your yard. And if the neighbor doesn't agree with that, the court's question then is, what recourse does that person have? The difficulty with that application in a city, in a dense population, is that there aren't really guidelines in the chapter about who decides what's farming and grazing and who decides what a partition fence is versus an ornamental fence. Because to the court's point, this chapter is not designed to and indeed has been applied to not control ornamental fences. So when the court suggests that the absurd result is that village residents and city residents have no recourse in terms of accomplishing a half payment from their neighbors, the answer is that the process of that skips the whole step of whether these are partition fences, whether this statute ever meant to apply to them in the first place.
Was there an argument below that this was not a partition fence?
There was not. No.
Okay, that's not part of this case, but it might be part of the next one.
Well, and the answer was offered in response to, does this not create an absurd result? In this case,
You can finish your answer, please.
In this case, we have a city resident who does have what is considered to be a partition fence, and the answer is there's no mechanism for the city to assist him in his efforts to get his neighbors to pay.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much.
May it please the court. My name is Scott Rasmussen. My clients, Dr. Stuart White and his wife, Janet White, are present today in the courtroom for your information. And we thank you for your time. I think it's great that the kids are here today to see how the court works. I have met some of you folks before at Dodge County Bar meetings, and I think it's great that the court meets the people outside, so to speak, so that they can appreciate how hard a job you have and all the responsibility that you have. So thank you very much for your job. I would like to start, I guess, as a rebuttal. I liked the question from Justice Bradley because one of my main arguments in this case is that Mr. and Mrs. White really do not have any redress under the law if they are required to have a fence, if we take counsel's argument in this case. What he ignores is that there is actually a case. It's Thomas Zuski, which is cited in the appellate brief, or appellate opinion, I should say. And Thomas Zuski stands for the point that the only place to litigate this fence dispute is through Chapter 90. It's an exclusive remedy under that case. And so, therefore, even though Chapter 90 requires Mr. and Mrs. White to have a fence because they do have livestock, the statute specifically requires them, they must have a fence, and tells them what kind of fence and what size wire and everything else that they have to have. But if we take his interpretation of the statute, the Whites cannot apportion the cost of that fence with their neighbors. And I think it's very much the intent of the legislature all the way through in regards to this chapter that there be an apportionment of fences. In other words, a cost sharing or responsibility of these fences. And that
Council, is it necessary that Chapter 90 provide the mechanism by which to enforce the obligation to share in the upkeep of the fences?
Yes.
Why?
Because there has to be some way then, first of all, if we follow Thomas Zuski, that's the only place to do it, is through Chapter 90. It's an exclusive remedy. But
why did we find that to be exclusive remedy?
Because Thomas Zuski says you cannot bring an action in circuit court to recover the cost of the fence. That's what that case was about.
Right. And that's because there was a statutory provision that controlled it, right?
Yes, but...
Okay. So if we decided that the enforcement mechanism in Chapter 90 applies only to towns, then there would be no statutory bar to bringing a case outside of Chapter 90 to enforce the obligation to share responsibility, right?
Well, then I guess you would have to make that distinction with the Thomas Zuski case, but otherwise I think Thomas Zuski is the law, and my clients cannot bring an action in circuit court. And I'll take this argument a little bit further, if you would. There has to be some mechanism to enforce this rule of apportioning offenses, and the legislature, I think their intent was that the only way to enforce this would be to put it on the tax roll of the township. That's what it says in the statute. Now, I think what they should have said is that same thing for the city, and that's where I got into my argument in my brief that this is a jurisdictional thing because it's based on who has the tax authority. So the township has tax authority under the people in the township only. They don't have tax authority in a city. So when the city here argues that, the Whites should go to the township to get redress, and that was one of their arguments in the trial court, that's absurd. And that is actually the word that is appropriate here. It's an absurd interpretation of the law because you can't expect the problem from the city to go on the tax roll of the township. They're two separate tax rolls. They're two separate jurisdictions. And so those responsibilities in regards to taxes flow with the municipal body, like a city or a township or a village. And that's why this law doesn't make any sense, is because the legislative revision that occurred in 1878 from the 1875 law left out that language. And the only way that I can square that is to say that my opinion is that they simply forgot it. There was a omission, and that's what the Court of Appeals calls it, an inadvertent omission. In other words, they didn't mean to do it. Of this language, and so I think it was a mistake, and so basically we're asking you to correct the mistake that was made between 1875 and 1878.
Council, do we have authority to correct legislative quote-unquote mistakes?
I think you have the right to interpret this case and say that that's the way it should apply.
Why would we need to do that? Why can't we look back at what the legislature in 1878 did? They changed the language. that applied the Fenn statute to cities, but at the same time, simultaneously, adopted a definition that says that towns can be construed as cities so long as it's not repugnant to the structure of the statute. Why can't we read it that way?
Well, I don't know how to answer that question. We didn't. That issue was not raised.
The best answer to that is you're perfectly free to read it that way.
Well, perhaps, but then I guess if we get into different ways to read the statute, then it becomes ambiguous because it comes down to, you know, do reasonable people come to two different conclusions as to what the statute says?
Well, that can't really be the definition of ambiguity if two people can come to different ways of looking at a statute. I mean, you have to look at the tools available to you, and if you have plain language with plain meaning, why not apply it?
Well, I think the Kalal case says that in the beginning. It says you look at the language of the statute, but they also go on to say that the test is whether reasonable people could construe the statute in two different senses. And in a different spot in the case, it says two well-informed reasonable people. And so if you look at that, I would say the fact that we're in court today with counsel interpreting this law one way and I'm interpreting it, the law the other way, I think we're both reasonable people, so therefore it's ambiguous.
But doesn't Chapter 990 provide a way for the court to find that there isn't an ambiguity? I'm not going to go through Justice Kelly's historical analysis or research that he previously laid out, but again, at the same time that the legislature removed the references to cities, et cetera, it also added a definition of town to include cities or villages. So perhaps the legislature was trying to be more efficient with its word choice and to provide a definition instead of peppering a statutory chapter with repetitive language when it had arguably defined the term already.
Well, there you used the word perhaps, and so I have a little problem with that word.
I'll delete it then. I withdraw it.
Thanks, because it's like let's speculate here, and I don't want to speculate.
I don't want to speculate either, but what I want to do is give meaning to what the legislature did.
And you know what? I totally agree with you, because in the Kalal case, it says first you're supposed to look to the language of the statute, and second, you're supposed to determine ambiguity. If there's ambiguity, and that can come from several different places. A lot of times counsel was arguing the ambiguity of words here. And we're not talking about the ambiguity of a word. We are talking about the ambiguity that was created in this statute when you compare Section 90.01 with 90.11. That's the ambiguity, and the Court of Appeals refers to that, saying that ambiguity can be caused by a conflict between the statutes.
And that's, do we have a conflict here?
I think we do. I think that first of all, I'd argue that cities are responsible for the whole chapter, and if you want to interpret 90.01 in that fashion, that's fine with me. But the bottom line is, I think the cities do have to be involved in this enforcement process. Otherwise, the people like the whites are disenfranchised, as Judge Bradley questioned counsel about, because they have no redress. And the purpose, let's look at the purpose. The Kalal case also says you're supposed to look at the context and purpose of the statute. The purpose of the statute has always been clear. The state of Wisconsin wants people with livestock to have a fence, and it requires them to have a fence. And then they go on to say, we're going to share, it's only fair to share that responsibility. That's what it says in the note that was referred to here from 1878. It says it's only fair that the city landowners share the same responsibility that the township landowners have.
Why is that so fair? I'm going to ask you, why isn't your argument leading us to somewhat of an absurd result? You're opposing counsel, so maybe it's absurd. You're opposing counsel advances that this is for partition fence, for livestock, for grazing. I think of a paraphrasing a popular line, you know, why that would be this. Just because I want chickens, why should you suffer, my neighbor? In other words, here I am in a city. I decide I want to raise some chickens. And now I'm going to be able to get my neighbors to pay for half of the fence?
I'm not sure, so sure it applies to chickens. The statute says livestock and grazing land. And actually, the definitions of those were looked at pretty closely in the appellate decision. This applies to grazing land for livestock.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe the chickens fit under the statute, maybe not. That might be another case for you someday. But I'm not so sure it applies today to our issues here today.
Okay, goats.
Oh, same. I probably agree with you.
Okay. I mean, so there is some, in my mind, some argument to be advanced that it shouldn't apply in cities because of the nature of cities, the generally smaller parcels of property.
Well, I don't think that is anywhere in the intent of the legislature for the statute. It just says grazing land. It doesn't say it has to be 1 acre, or it doesn't say 1/10 of an acre. There's no restriction on size. And what I would say also here is that this land was farmland since 1837, and it's always been farmland. But the city of Watertown grew around it and enclosed it, and now we have this issue. So does that take away my client's rights to be compensated for half the cost of the fence under the statute? I don't think so. I think it should apply. And by the way, there's a lot of hobby farms with people that have horses or cows or whatever, and I think it's becoming more popular. So if your question is the law relevant, I think yes, it is.
I live in a township, so I'm not personally affected, and I say this with a smile, but I wonder how fair it is to have my neighbors be responsible for building a fence if I decide to have goats on a few acres.
Well, I think it has to deal with responsibility, okay? If somebody decides to have a cow or horse or goats, I think that they have to be responsible, and that's why the statute is there. Really, then the first place is to make livestock owners responsible for those animals. And it protects, actually, good fences make good neighbors, right? I had to get that in.
I almost did, too. And the name of
waiting,
the poet is?
Robert Frost. So your students can look that poem up. But we're quoting for now from a poet. But it really is true, because if the animals leave that person's property and go do damage to the neighbor's rose bush or garden, then there's going to be a lawsuit. This statute is there for a reason. I think it prevents a lot of those issues from occurring so that you don't have livestock wandering off, which they tend to do. I don't know, every time I go out in the country, you see the cow poking its head through the fence because the grass is always greener on the other side, right? So they travel around. That's why you have to have a fence. That's why the statute is there.
But these are policy considerations and issues that are not for the court to evaluate, right? That's the legislature's area.
Well, I don't know. I read that this court is responsible for policy decisions, so I would disagree with you. I think that, but really what you're looking at, not policy so much as purpose. Okay, look at the purpose of the
Aren't
statute.
I supposed to look at the text of the statute and apply it regardless of whether I think it's good, bad policy? I mean, we elect legislators to make policy, not the justices of this court.
Maybe we're talking two different things. I think you have to look at what the purpose of the statute is. You do have to read the language. And I think that the language is not by itself ambiguous. I said this before. What is ambiguous here is comparing one statute to the other.
Just to clarify, comparing which statute to which statute?
90.01 and 90.15 out of Chapter 90 contain the word city. All the rest of the statutes do not contain the word city. And so when you compare 90.01 and 90.15 to the other sections of Chapter 90, that is what creates the ambiguity. And that is also in the Court of Appeals decision. There is case law that says that ambiguity can be caused by comparison of the statutes. And that also goes along with the Kalal case, because you're supposed to look at the context. And to me, if you're going to look at the context of this law, you have to compare the different sections under Chapter 90 to each other. And that's where the problem arises, is that the legislature, I think, through mistake or inadvertence, as the Court of Appeals said, left this language out. And it's too bad that they did. We can't talk to them now anymore. But the only thing that we really have is this note that is referred to in the appellate decision from the reviser in 1878. And so that's where it goes into this fairness argument. And that's one of the basis for the appellate decision in this case, is that it simply would not be fair to not treat the people in city and villages the same as people in townships. So that's, I think, a very good argument. Otherwise, it's like you're creating a different class of people, and this law doesn't apply to city owners. It doesn't make any sense to me, and that's why I say it's absurd. And the Kalal case also talks about that, that you're supposed to read these statutes together in context so that it makes common sense. There's another case.
Well, counsel, if we follow your argument, the most direct piece of evidence about what the legislature meant in 1878 was that it omitted application to the cities. That seems pretty powerful. If you're not going to come along with me with the way I read statutory history, if we put that aside, the fact that the legislature took this out tells me we have no business putting it back in.
I don't think they took it out. I think it was an omission.
Do you know that?
Well, we don't, because we can't talk to those people, unfortunately.
And then how were we to infer what they intended? We can't talk to them.
Because
they didn't, and they don't have any collective will other than what they write.
Okay, I guess I would just turn that around and say, how do we have any knowledge that their intent was to leave it out?
Because it is not there anymore.
Well, I don't see it in the notes saying, hey, we should leave this part out now.
I'm not interested in the notes. I have no idea what the legislature thought. I have no idea what they intended. I have no interest in what they intended. What I do have an interest in is what they said. And what they said is what they put in writing. And here, you're telling me that the requirement that defense provisions apply to the cities does not appear in the statutes anymore. It's just not there. And you want us to supply it. It was there before. It is not there now. Why are we supposed to put it back in when we can't crawl into the heads of the legislators back in 1878?
Well, I would argue that it's implied that it should apply to the cities. Because the word city was included for the first time in 1878 into the statutes.
And the legislature can't take that out?
Well, pardon me, but the law of the state in 1853 or whenever this 1847, when the state became a state, was that the word city was not in that statute. I believe it was Chapter 55 then, or Chapter 14. I can't remember the numbers now. Yeah. But it turned into Chapter 90, and that's the first time that the word city was used in this chapter.
The first time it was used with respect to fence viewers was in 1875.
Correct.
Yeah.
Counsel, if I could just shift your focus a little bit. As I read the concerns of the parties, I took them in the context of Chapter 90 as a whole. So you didn't argue all of the different sections of Chapter 90 to us, but I noted as I was getting ready for our argument that 90.035 talks about when two of the parties, one of whom is the state or a subdivision thereof, such as, but a city, a town, a county, agree a fence is reasonably necessary, the duty to erect and maintain partition fences shall apply equally to the state as provided in 90.03 and its subdivisions as occupants of lands wherever the lands are bounded. That seems to me to be a very broad provision that talks about fences on property that is either in a city, outside of a city, in a town, outside of a town, generally in a county, or perhaps even on lands, I don't know if there are state lands where grazing is permitted. But it seems to me to be very broad. I won't go through others' parts of the chapter, but other parts also use words. They don't say city, but they use very broad descriptive terms to talk about the obligation to have and maintain partition fences. So is there any reason that we should not interpret the section under review here in light of the whole chapter rather than just microscopically examining it within itself?
I think you have to look at the whole chapter. And that goes, again, to the purpose. The purpose is to require people to have fences, and second, that the cost thereof should be apportioned. And that particular passage that you're talking to, I think, is just a dispute resolution mechanism. When there's another jurisdiction involved, like state land inside of a city, could be a state park inside the city of Madison, for example. Yeah. Or I think maybe Judge Bradley said, well, what about two different townships, you know? And so that's why there is actually a section, I think it's 90.14, that
talks
deals
about a fence on a town line.
On a
right?
town line, and yeah. It gives a way to resolve that. And here gets me to the bigger picture. The bigger picture here is really, I think, the beauty of Chapter 90 is a dispute resolution system for people that have these types of issues, and so that they don't end up in court. It is done by the local people. In other words, you have the alderman in their district, as Judge Kelly said, in their district, and you have the township people in their township viewing this land. And it's not a borrowing system. I reject that argument. They are saying, well, it just creates extra fence viewers. No, the statute is specific. The fence viewer has to be in their district, in other words, on their piece of land. And that only makes sense because they're familiar with it. So because they're familiar with it, and so it gives the local people a way to resolve this dispute without resorting to court.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I think I'm done. I would just like to say that we would like the city to live up to its duty here. That's why we came to court in the first place in Jefferson County. And believe me, my clients never expected to be here today before the Supreme Court on this case. It started out rather quite simply. And here we are deciding what might make new law or policy. And it's very interesting to me, and I thank you for your time. Is there anything else?
Thank you.
I will conclude.
I will touch upon in rebuttal only those arguments that counsel proposed in his oral argument. As I have an opportunity to consider the court's questions and the ramifications thereof, the direction of the questioning was, should the Wisconsin Supreme Court use a catch-all definition of towns to create enforcement responsibilities and enforcement powers for cities and villages? I would caution against that. I would caution that setting a precedent that the use of a catch-all phrase to delineate powers for independent municipalities, independent municipal entities, is dangerously close to legislation for purposes of this kind of thing, for this kind of interpretation of a statute that has been variously pointed out contains a specific removal of those powers, at least by verbiage.
Counsel, earlier you suggested that the interpretation of the statute that I proposed would require the addition of several extra words. Do you recall
Correct.
That? Okay. The Chapter 285, Section 1 of 1875, the one that made the fence viewing requirements applicable to cities, they didn't include any of those words that you suggested would be necessary. Would that suggest to you that the law of 1875 was ineffective in applying the fence viewing requirements to the cities?
No, I think what they did in 1875, however, is include a provision that says, and I can't quote it exactly for our, the court, but it says something like, cities and villages are now charged with the exercise of the duties and the enforcement responsibilities defined in this chapter.
Yeah, to discharge the duties imposed upon fence viewers of the several towns.
Right. Yeah. So there was a specific provision in 1875 that assigned those. You are correct. I don't recall how many subsections Chapter 55 was back in 1875. But there was a provision within that legislation that said, we hereby assign to you, cities and villages, these responsibilities and these powers.
Right.
That was removed.
Yeah, but they didn't need to include all the additional list of words that you suggested were necessary to make this applicable to the cities, right?
Point taken. I mean, okay. the court could substitute two sentences at the end of one of these that says, all these powers are hereby, all these responsibilities and the attendant powers are hereby assigned to cities and villages.
Or
but that would
might,
have to be in the legislation.
Or we might just apply the definitional section that says towns can be read as cities, and that would, by main force, assign all of the responsibilities of the towns to the cities. Yeah.
I recognize that, and that's why I suggest that using a catch-all phrase from a separate chapter, from Chapter 990, to effectively equate cities, villages, and towns for the power of enforcement and for the punishment, essentially, for the imposition of the charges onto the tax bill, that seems like a monumental step, when the flip side of that is we read the words as they are, and if that's what the legislature intends, then go to the legislature and have them do it.
Counsel, with regard to 990, it says, as previously indicated, that town may be construed to include cities, villages, wards, or districts. I'm not all that familiar with municipal law. Sounds to me like your position would give you some special knowledge. I'm hesitant because I am familiar enough to know that towns and villages and cities have different powers,
right.
And I'm just concerned of the ramifications of construing, although the statute says it may be construing it. What are the ramifications, if any, in terms of other distinct powers and duties of distinct subdivisions of government?
Right, and if I'll take some liberties with the definitions, but a city is an incorporated, it's a corporation. A village is essentially, I guess it would be the corporate level of maybe a service corporation. Towns are unincorporated. So what we're dealing with here is the ability for self-rule, for home rule, for those kinds of things become implicated when you throw all three of them into the same pot. The purpose of incorporating, the purpose of a city, the city now has powers to do things like annex, and has powers to create taxing bases, and it has powers to enforce its own laws and ordinances. Villages take a step down in terms of the opportunities they have to do those kinds of things. Towns are not corporations. Towns derive their power strictly from the state. And so what we have in this kind of situation where what we're wrestling with is, can we take a statute 990 Should I finish?
Yes, finish your thought.
Thank you. And assign to it the ability to take powers that were specifically assigned to one unincorporated entity and apply them to corporate entities. I think that's something the legislature has to do. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for interesting arguments. This is the first time I ever heard about a partition fence, having not grown up on a farm, and my neighbors don't have goats or chickens or cows, so I just didn't have this opportunity. The briefs were very good and very informative, and I'm sure you can tell the court has enjoyed the argument you presented. So we are going to adjourn. The court will meet again in closed conference at 3:10. We are adjourned. Thank you.